The Outlet. The talk of Queenstown.
Welcome to The Outlet. I'm your host, Brent Harbour. In this podcast, I catch up with Guyon Espiner, presenter and journalist at RNZ, and author of the book, The Drinking Game. Guyon will be sharing insights from his upcoming participation in Aspiring Conversations at the Lake Wanaka Centre from Thursday, April 4th till 7th. We'll talk about the current state of media, the panels he'll be on, and more.
For the latest local news, sport, information, and entertainment, download the Queenstown app. This is The Outlet.
Hi, Guy, and welcome to The Outlet podcast.
Kia ora, and thanks very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Now, you're involved in two discussions at Aspiring Conversations. The first one I want to talk about is Breakfast with Papers. So you're doing that with Paddy Gower and Susie Ferguson. How do you approach discussing both significant and probably some of the lesser-known news stories when you're on a panel?
Oh, really looking forward to this one because Paddy's a good mate of mine. I've known Paddy for a long time. We actually worked back in the press gallery at Parliament together when he was at the New Zealand Herald and I was at PNZ, and then he moved into TV3. And so I've known Paddy for a long time, so it'll be good to engage with him there. And of course, Susie Ferguson, I co-presented Morning Report with her for 5 years at god-awful times of the morning. And so, yeah, I'll be kicking around the stories of the day at that point. So I think it's a really cool idea, and it'll allow us to broaden out and hopefully talk a little bit about the media and how stories get it as well, because that's probably quite a big issue at the moment in terms of trust in the media, right? And how stories are selected and how they're reported. So yeah, hopefully we can touch on some of that stuff as well. Who knows what's going to be happening on the day that we kick around, but I think the broader issues about the media there as well, and it'll be really fun to discuss it with two people I've worked very closely with, so I'm looking forward to that.
You will be talking about the news of the day, but I imagine that the terrible couple of weeks that we've had with the proposed closure of News Hub and cuts at TVNZ is going to lead to some discussion about journalism and media, and you know, it's terrible that there's going to be all these people out of jobs, but what are your biggest concerns around a shrinking news service and also around journalism?
Yeah, it's pretty frightening. I mean, I've been in journalism for 30 years now, and I started in newspapers 10 years there and pretty much 10 years in television and now about 10 years in radio. So I've given all three of the mediums a fair crack and sort of toggle between all of them nowadays. It's fair to say that for all of my career, media companies struggle and have struggled, but I've never seen anything like this. This is really, you know, looking fairly apocalyptic. And it is deeply worrying. It's hard for us to discuss it because people can quite naturally say, oh, well, you would say that, wouldn't you, because it's your career and you guys are sort of looking after yourselves. And you can sound quite pompous when you talk about the bigger effects, but they are very real. You know, you don't have to look far around the world to see examples of countries which don't have a strong media, and that means they don't have a strong democracy or often strong systems of government as well. So it is that serious. One of my favourite sayings, and it probably needs to be updated for the modern world, but the saying is that where the papers are full of good news, the jails are full of good men. And what it means is what it sounds like. If you don't have a media that is scrutinising things, that is catching out wrongdoing, that is doing stress tests on policy, that is digging behind to see who's taken what or who's broken the rules, or if you don't have a referee, you've got problems. Everyone understands that, right? Anyone who watches a game of rugby or looks at a business environment when there aren't clear rules of competition and of someone being a watchdog to make sure people are following the rules, it's human nature for people to break them. When you give that away, and I look at a program like Fair Go, and, you know, a business that for years you get that call from, I'm a reporter for Fair Go, you know, because they fulfill that watchdog role. And they did that very clearly and very directly. But the broader role for media is exactly that. And because we hear those phrases so often, like holding power to account or democracy dies in darkness, etc., they can sound trite or pompous or, you know, like sort of throwaway lines or self-interest. But it is that real. I don't think when anyone really sits down to think about it, they could honestly believe we could have a good, strong democracy without a strong, robust media. So that is a real, genuine fear. And, you know, when you layer on top of a broken business model and a falling media, the possibility and reality of AI and deepfake news and a disinformation crisis, you really do start to worry. And you look at parts of America and where they're going, and you think, you know, we may not be too far behind. So when you see a whole newsroom at News Hub, very innovative and very, you know, assertive journalists closing down, and you see the sort of cuts that we've had at TVNZ and other media companies also in trouble, that's trouble for democracy as well, in my view, certainly.
When we see politicians echoing things that you get on social media, like fake news and all these kind of things, I mean, and our very own politicians have been talking about being paid off by the Public Interest Journalism Fund, and I see things like that all the time. I was in radio for 38 years, and, you know, part of doing this podcast, we've got funding from the Public Interest Journalism Fund. So, you know, they're there saying you're pushing an agenda and all these things. But what I see is that what we're doing with the Public Interest Journalism Fund helps in the regions, because we are telling those stories of people, of charities, of innovative companies, all these kind of things. So the trust in media thing is a real problem when it's echoed by the government, isn't it?
Well, I think that's a very good point. And remember that the Public Interest Journalism Fund was unfurled after the COVID lockdowns. The pandemic faced massive challenges for much of the economy. And if you remember, magazines like North and South and The Listener had stopped publishing, remember, because they weren't emergency outlets. And we had real closures threatened. And it was sparked out of there, as well as other challenges that were being faced. But yeah, I mean, the idea that the media were bribed over that, I mean, it doesn't stand up more than about 30 seconds of scrutiny. It must have been the worst $55 million bribe in history, because the Labor government halved its support at the 2023 election and went from a majority to 25% or whatever they got. Look, come on, most journalists are equal opportunity botherers. They are after stories, regardless of who's in power. And that's what I've seen all my life. I've never seen a journalist sit around with an agenda thinking, let's go after him, let's not go after that person. And, you know, bias is a bit like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. And when you actually unpick the records of some of these journalists that people were going after, you'll find that just as aggressive with the right as they have with the left. I agree with you, having politicians that promulgate this narrative is unhelpful. Again, I turn to the American example. Trump has called the media the enemy of the state or the enemy of the people, and you get that rallying cry picked up by his supporters. If you want to go into a world where no one believes anything that they see in the media, then we're in real trouble. If you can't have an agreed set of facts, then you can't have a sensible conversation about what the solution is. You know, I'm not suggesting that there should be one solution. Everyone's got a different idea of, you know, say, how to solve child poverty or welfare issues. You know, the centre-right may have one way out, and the centre-left may believe another thing. And that's good. That's the sort of robustness we believe. But if you can't agree on an agreed set of facts, start that conversation, then you're in real trouble. And so when you start portraying the media as the enemy here, then I think you've got real issues. So I do find that disturbing.
I mean, I've been in the media, as I said, for a long time too, and I've never been asked to push anything or to push any narrative. And when I talk to people, and, you know, of late, they're quite aggressive when they find out that you're in the media, which is a real concern. I just go, I've never been asked to do it. I don't understand. And I sit down and I listen to radio and I watch television, and people have opinions, but I mean, we can't have a world where there is no opinion, can we?
No. And I think we do need some self-reflection ourselves into what we can do better. I think there's been a lot of conversation recently about we should be clearer when at times when things are opinion versus factually based. And perhaps we've gone too far with the extent of opinion columns and opinion giving in our media. But again, that probably is partly influenced by the business model. It's a lot cheaper to hire people to do opinion pieces and that's them off. So you get an issue there. So I think we need to be clear about delineating between fact and opinion. Back in the day when I first started, newspapers said, you know, opinions were a bit like the obvious, you know, everyone had one. And it was our job to get out there, get the facts. And, you know, as someone who's done presenting roles in the past, I sort of went back into being a reporter with a small r, and that's what I do for a lot of my day job, is go out there and try to get the facts. So, you know, we have to look at ourselves as well. And And I also wonder whether we do a good enough job of explaining what it is that we actually do. I think the idea that the media can somehow just write whatever it likes is commonly held and utterly wrong. Defamation laws in New Zealand are very strong. You get sued if you say something about someone that's not true, that you can't prove. We have a Broadcasting Standards Authority for mainstream media anyway, and a lot of checks and balances, and there's a lot of care that goes into that. I mean, I work at Radio New Zealand, RNZ. You know, there are scores of journalists who every day are trying to get the facts and doing their utmost to tell the truth. We don't always get it right. Sometimes we, you know, the tone is wrong, or sometimes if errors are made and they are corrected. But there's a lot of good faith attempts to tell the truth out there. And, you know, it would be nice if that was recognised, but maybe we need to do more to explain to the public what it is that we do and how we do it.
Yeah, I think so. Like any business, reflection and trying to improve things. And I see that we're talking about looking at the Broadcasting Act 1989, which does need an update, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned 1989 because that's when the industry was deregulated, and that's when TV3 got the license to join TVNZ as broadcasters. So it is a bit disturbing to think we might go back to a pre-1989 world where there's only one television news service, and if that's the state-owned one, then I'm not sure that is going to help remedy the kinds of issues that we've been talking about.
Now, the other panel you're on too is the drinking game, and this one will be a little bit more personal as you'll talk about your decision to stop drinking. But before we talk about that, can you share what prompted your decision to write The Drinking Game and delve into the complexities of New Zealand's drinking culture?
Sure. Well, I did a documentary at RNZ. We actually screened on TVNZ in the end, and it's still available on YouTube if anyone wants to watch it for free. It's called Proof. We made that in 2021, and pretty much the day after it screened on TVNZ in November of 2021, I got a call from Alan and Unwin, who said, would you do a book on this and make a book version? And I thought about it, thought, yeah, that'd be good. So, yeah, it's part memoir about my own experiences with alcohol, which are pretty normal, actually, unfortunately, for people of my age, Gen Xers, born in 1970, who grew up as, you know, early to mid-teenagers and starting drinking and going down that route, which is a very heavy drinking culture that we still have in New Zealand. Things changed a bit, but that was certainly the world that I grew up in. But I also broadened it out a lot to look at why we have that culture of heavy drinking in New Zealand, and also the sort of the other factors of the industry and the interface and engagement between the alcohol industry and politics, and the lobbying that goes on for alcohol regulation or the lack of it. And they seem to have been very successful at keeping our regulation at bay. So it's part memoir, The Drinking Game, but it's also mainly journalism, a work of journalism, and looking at the industry, the size of the industry, the rules around advertising and sponsorship of sport, those types of things. So it's a pretty good look at the different elements that go into drinking culture. So I'm looking forward to speaking to a lot of Dan, who's a big influence on me, and is a good friend of mine. Her and her husband, Corin Dan, are good friends. And of course, Paddy Gower too, who've talked about already, but had a pretty similar journey. And in fact, our docos came out, I think, within weeks of each other. I think I might have pipped him to the post on that one, but that was probably a first. Paddy used to scoop me in the gallery, so it was nice to get in before him for once.
It is interesting because I was talking about it with a friend of mine about the culture around drinking in New Zealand. I grew up when Mum and Dad had a bar in our house, you know, and they used to invite people around from the factory and their business. And there was drinking going on around me all the time. Now, it sounds like I'm a bit of a wowser here with it, but I've never been drunk in my life. And it didn't influence me to try and drink. I wasn't interested in it, but it was a constant there, and you just took it as the norm, didn't you?
Wow, yeah, no, that's an interesting story in itself, and good on you for that. I certainly couldn't say that. I couldn't have said it after about my 14th birthday. Yeah, the thing that really struck me when I gave up drinking in 2019, it was about mid-2019, was that, you know, I'd been a heavy drinker for 35 plus years, and no one had ever said to me, you know, why do you drink so much? But when I stopped drinking, people were like, why aren't you drinking? And you know, it was just like the whole burden of proof, if you like, was reversed. And I felt a lot of social pressure to justify why I wasn't taking a class one carcinogen, which is quite a bizarre thing when you think about it. And I think that's the thing that you get when you have hyper-normalization of something. It's so ingrained in every aspect of our lives. You know, I call it sort of birth, death, marriage thing. You know, what do you do when a kid's born? You wet the baby's head and drink alcohol. What do you do when, you know, when someone dies, when you have a wake and drink alcohol? What do you do when you get a job? You congratulate your mate by going to the pub. What do you do when you lose your job and you commiserate down at the pub? So when you associate it with every aspect of life, and then they're sponsoring the tennis, and they're sponsoring the ballet, and they're sponsoring the rugby league, and you get into the situation where you're just surrounded, and it just leaches into every aspect of life. And if it's normal, then it's not a drug. And that's the thing. I mean, it intellectually we know it's a drug, but we don't associate it with a drug. And if you said to someone who drinks quite a bit, do you take drugs? They'd say no. Which, you know, and they wouldn't think about it. So it allowed me, and that's why I started and made the doco and then the book, was because not at all to preach, and you won't find any preachiness. I mean, if you want to drink alcohol, absolutely you're fine. I still love going to pubs. I usually have alcohol in the house for when your mates come around. I got no issue with it. Oh, and I love going to pubs, I love going out. No problem with that. But it just allowed me, when I stepped out of that drinking culture, totally to see it with new eyes and question some of those things. And I think that's what we need to do. And I've spent a lifetime doing that in journalism. So I thought, why don't I have a look at the alcohol industry and the alcohol culture in New Zealand?
Yeah, there was a question the other day too that a lot of people were struggling to answer. And I had to think about it myself. I've got my daughters are all in their starting in their 20s and early 20s now. But there was a question about, should you let your teens drink alcohol-free versions of beers and spirits? And I had to sit back and I was chatting to my wife going, I just don't know how I would answer that myself. What are your feelings on that?
Yeah, I've got a bit of a problem with the alcohol-free drinks. I should back up a little bit. For adults who do drink, I think that they can be a really good way to moderate their drinking, to take breaks between drinks, or just have a night out where they're not drinking and they're not getting that social pressure from their friends because, you know, they've got a zero beer or whatever. So they can be quite useful. I don't drink them at all. I don't want to do the fake alcohol thing because what's the next step for me? Is it the low alcohol beer and then am I back on the wagon? But the other thing that worries me a little bit is, even if you, and I won't mention any brand names here for obvious reasons, but we all know what we're talking about. If you are having all that with the logo, you are embedding the name and the idea of that brand in there. And I tell you what, when I look at an ad that says, you know, if you're driving tonight, drink such and such a beer with no alcohol, and I see the ad, I immediately turn to the full strength product in my brain, you know. And the thing called alibi marketing, which is very clever, and you will have seen it with the Formula One racing cars decked out in the livery of a cigarette box. They're not allowed to use that imagery, but you can tell from the geometric shapes of a red and white car that it looks exactly like a packet of cigarettes. They were the same, the booze companies in France, where it's illegal to have, they banned all alcohol advertising sponsorship of sport many, many years ago in France. And so when there are big championships over there, there have been efforts to just use half the slogan, you know, like such a beer, probably the best beer in the world or whatever it is, probably the best dot, dot, dot. And so you haven't broken the rule, but in your mind, you know exactly what you're talking about. So I'm a little bit suspicious of some of these big liquor brands that tend to use their products as, you know, a bit of a marketing ploy. I'm not against them for people who do drink, but my own view, and I am a dad, my own view would be I wouldn't go anywhere near letting kids do that. Why would you give these big companies the leverage and the entree into your kids' minds and putting that whole idea in there? So no, I'm a bit suspicious of that. I think those should be left to people who do drink. And want to just take it a bit easier.
What are you hoping the audience is going to take away from this conversation about the obstacles and motivations behind giving up drinking?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not, I'm not an advocate for, and I can see how people might think this, but I'm not an advocate for giving up drinking at all. I don't want anyone to give up drinking who doesn't want to. That's not what I'm about. I'm about having a fresh look at why you're drinking. If you like your drinking and you're happy with it and it's a net positive in your life, go for it, is my view, absolutely. I'm asking people to have a good look at what the forces are that influence you. And we talked a little bit before about that peer pressure, which doesn't just happen at 14, happens at 44 or 54.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. Where people are like, well, why aren't you drinking tonight? So I'm looking at those sorts of things in culture, but I'm also looking at things like why it is that we allow alcohol companies to support breast cancer foundations when, you know, it's a known cause of cancer, of why we allow alcohol companies to associate themselves with our biggest heroes in the All Blacks or yachting, whatever it is, why every attempt to regulate alcohol gets knocked back by the politicians who, you know, get the knock at the door or at some point decide this is too hard, why any attempts to regulate are always up for liberalisation of laws. There are members' bills at the moment allowing you to take alcohol to the races or to open up opening hours so you can watch the rugby with a beer at 5 in the morning if it's being played overseas, as though you could never watch the rugby without a beer. So, you know, that's what I'm interested in, is our attitude and our regulation towards alcohol and why we allow the most dangerous drug we have to be so lightly regulated when we jump on drugs that are scientifically proven to be far less harmful. And so I'm looking at that rather than people's own decisions. If you can drink alcohol well and you enjoy it and you're not hurting anyone else, then go for it, is my perspective. So I'm certainly not about people giving up drinking. I'm about people thinking clearly about what the forces may be behind their drinking.
It sounds like you're going to have a great time. And one of the beautiful things about Aspiring Conversations, it's one of the most beautiful places in the country. Do you have anything that you love to do when you visit the region?
Well, Paddy Gower has been threatening a mountain bike ride. Not quite sure what he's got in mind. He's got a high risk appetite, Paddy Gower, as anyone has ever seen him on the news would know. And Corin Dan's a good mate as well. We've all been political editors at various points. We're all good mates. So I think Paddy's going to lead the charge in a mountain biking ride at some point, which would be cool. So yeah, really looking down forward to getting down there, and when I'm not on the podium having these sorts of discussions, possibly getting out and doing some mountain biking and taking in some of the beautiful sights.
Well, Guyon, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you today. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks very much for the opportunity. Really nice to speak to you too.
On Buzzsprout, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts, The Outlet.
The talk of Queenstown.
Thanks for listening to The Outlet, your local interview podcast for Queenstown. Now, if you have a story or an interview you think should be featured on The Outlet podcast, please get in touch by using the contact button on your Queenstown app. The Outlet is produced and published by the Queenstown app and supported with funding from the New Zealand Public Interest Journalism Fund. All episodes of The Outlet are available on the podcast button on your Queenstown app and wherever you get your podcasts.